The guards leave the gate unlocked and came after closing to arrange the flowers. I called and gave him the cue to light the candles for me. I owe a few people some really good bottles of wine. So, did I do good? He'd blown her away. She'd thought they'd get married, but she thought it would be a decision they made together, and then they'd drive down to the courthouse. She never expected Dan to propose, to go to so much effort to surprise and amaze her. She couldn't stop smiling. She couldn't recall the last time her face hurt from smiling so much. "You did good," she said. She twisted her ring in the fading light coming through the window, watching the diamond surrounding the large center diamond sparkle and flicker. Out the window, gentle waves rippled on Puget Sound, and sailboats tacked into and against the wind. It was perfect. The entire night was perfect. Until she realized the view was almost directly in line with the honey hole where Kurt Schill had pulled up the crab pot containing Andrea Strickland's body. Chapter 23. Thursday morning, Tracy arrived at the office tired from a fitful night's sleep. After dinner, she and Dan had returned home and made love. Getting to sleep had not been a problem, but she had awakened at just after 3, out of breath, her nightshirt soaked with sweat, the way it used to get when she'd been dreaming of Sarah. This time, the nightmare had nothing to do with her sister. This time, in the nightmare, Tracy had been sitting in Kurt Schill's boat on Puget Sound, struggling to raise the crab pot, arms straining to pull the line through the block at the end of the davit pole. It seemed she'd pulled forever, yard after yard of rope, winding in a neat circle around her feet until finally the crab pot breached the surface. She tied off the rope and carefully slid across the seat, feeling the boat tip off balance. Carefully she stretched out her arm. The boat inched closer to the water's surface. She strained to reach the cage, fingers twitching, just inches from the metal. A hand shot out from between the bars, the polished blue fingernails gripping her arm, yanking her overboard into the dark waters. Tracy had lain in bed, unable to get back to sleep. Her mind churned over the evidence in the Andrea Strickland case, something about the dream bothering her, though what exactly she couldn't be sure. She read on her Kindle until 6 o'clock, then got up and made Dan breakfast in bed, which seemed a poor trade for all the effort he'd gone to the day before. After they'd eaten, she made her way into the office. Tracy stepped off the elevator, in no hurry now that Pierce County had taken back her only open murder. The A-team was back to working their regular schedule. 2 months on day shifts, then they'd work a month on nights. She'd do the legwork on her other violent crime cases and get those that didn't plead prepared for trial. As she walked the hallway, her section came alive. She smelled the bittersweet aroma of coffee and heard the voices of her colleagues and of the morning newscasters from the flat screen. Mentally, she was settling into the thought of a relaxing morning when she entered her bullpen and saw the yellow sticky note on her computer monitor summoning her. "See me in conference room immediately when you get in." Knowing Nolasco, with the Strickland case no longer filling Tracy's plate, he'd give her some administrative crap, a tedious project like digging through boxes of old files he'd been avoiding, but would now say he needed ASAP. The blinds on the windows had been drawn, preventing her from seeing into the conference room. She reached the open door, about to knock, but caught herself when she saw others seated at the table. She momentarily thought she'd walked in on a meeting. Nolasco sat on the far side of the table beside Stephen Martinez, the assistant chief of criminal investigations, Nolasco's immediate superior. On the other side of the table, the side closest to the door, sat Stan Fields, and an officer Tracy could venture a good guess was Fields's captain, a pale, pudgy, officious-looking man, bearing an expression like his shorts were too tight and riding up on him. She also had a good guess why they'd all gathered. Stan Fields had ratted her out.
"Come in, Detective Crosswhite," Martinez said, voice grim. He gestured to the chair at the head of the table. Apparently, she didn't get to choose sides. Nolasco and Martinez sat on her right, Fields and his captain on her left. Foz had once described Martinez as a pit bull because of his short legs and stout body. His salt-and-pepper crew cut accentuated a prominent jaw, and he had intense, light-blue eyes. Martinez chose to wear a uniform at all times, and it added to his image as a no-nonsense cop. Tracy could feel the tension in the room, as if a gas leak could cause an explosion with just the faintest spark. Fields had only briefly glanced up when Tracy entered, but she'd looked hard at him. He wore a collared gray dress shirt beneath a brown suede jacket. This guy had really missed his decade for fashion. When Tracy sat, Martinez nodded to Nolasco, who adjusted in his chair, the leather creaking.
"Detective Crosswhite, I'm going to cut to the chase here. We've received a complaint from Captain Jessup of the Pierce County Major Crimes Unit that you interfered with their investigation of the Andrea Strickland matter. Do you know anything about that?"
Tracy struggled to keep her temper from being the spark that ignited the room. A part of her was pissed at Nolasco, who could have handled this matter internally, but chose instead to put on a show, likely for Martinez. She shifted her gaze to Stan Fields, not about to let him hide behind his captain. Fields's facial expression remained largely disguised by the thick gray mustache, but his eyes held the bemused glint of a schoolboy who knew he'd screwed up and had found a way to shift blame. Tracy's initial judgment of Fields had been only partially correct. Yes, he was a sexist, lazy ass, but he was also an insecure, vindictive prick, too stupid or arrogant to realize she'd handed him information that could help his investigation, and she'd been content to let him take all the credit, whatever might have come from it. Instead, he'd directed the spotlight back on Tracy, apparently failing to realize it only illuminated his own incompetence. So be it. If Fields wanted to drag her before her captain, she was more than happy to let his captain know his detective couldn't find his ass with both hands.
"Do I know anything about it?" she said.
"I know that I had lunch with Detective Fields yesterday and provided him with additional information relevant to the investigation."
"What information exactly?" Nolasco asked.
Nolasco already had the answer to that question, because Fields had run to his captain the minute he got back to Tacoma and told him, and Jessup had clearly called SPD. "I provided him with the details of an interview I conducted with Andrea Strickland's aunt, as well as her counselor. I also provided him with information we received from a skip tracer I'd asked to determine if anyone in his world had been asking about a Lynn Hoff." Tracy turned to Jessup, speaking to him as if he were a little slow. "If you'd like me to explain who these people are, since you won't find them in your detective's file, I'd be happy to." Jessup's cheeks flushed red, and the bemused glint in Fields's eyes sharpened.
"When did you conduct the interviews of the aunt and the counselor?" Nolasco asked.
"Last Friday," she said, turning back to him.
"After Pierce County had reasserted jurisdiction,"
Jessup said to Nolasco, in case anyone in the room was too stupid to figure that out on his own.
"Yes," Tracy said.
"So you flew to Los Angeles on official SPD business after this department no longer had jurisdiction of the case?"
Nolasco said.
"No, I flew to Los Angeles on personal business. I spoke to the aunt on my personal day. I didn't know about the counselor until I spoke with the aunt. She arranged for me to speak to him and to obtain Andrea Strickland's file. That's how good police work is conducted," she said, looking again to Jessup and Fields.
"I provided that information to Detective Fields."
Jessup said,
"Personal business?"
not trying to hide his skepticism.
"That's right. I flew to Los Angeles for a long weekend with my boyfriend. I paid for the flight, and the hotel, and all meals." She looked to Nolasco.
"I used the time to follow through with the conversation I'd set up with the aunt, as you'd instructed."
Nolasco's eyes narrowed in concern.
"As I instructed?"
"Yes, Captain. You told us to wrap up anything we had working, and to provide written reports to Pierce County, so their file would be complete
and they could hit the ground running. I had already arranged a telephone meeting with the aunt. Since I was traveling to L.A., I thought it better to do the interview in person. Martinez cleared his throat.
"Be that as it may,"
he said, his voice as deep and gravelly as a comic book villain's.
"Your discussion with the aunt was related to the victim's disappearance, was it not?"
"No. It was related to the victim's murder," Tracy said, keeping her tone flat and professional. "Pierce County handled the disappearance. Our jurisdiction was her murder." Martinez said,
"And that discussion took place after SPD had relinquished jurisdiction?"
"My discussion with the aunt? Technically, yes."
"So it's really semantics, isn't it, to say you are not on official SPD business?"
"I could see how someone could look at it that way, but I wasn't."
"How would you look at it, detective?"
Jessup asked, clearly struggling to keep his composure. Tracy had already decided she liked Jessup about as much as she liked Fields. Since he wasn't her captain, she didn't feel compelled to answer him. But she did so because it gave her the chance to take a dig at Fields. "I'd look at it as a dedicated police detective taking steps to complete her file, as instructed by her captain, so that all relevant information could be provided to the agency taking over jurisdiction, with the common goal of capturing the murderer, sir." Jessup gave her a sardonic smile.
"So you think we should say thank you?"
"You're welcome." Jessup flushed again and looked across the table to Nolasco and Martinez, who looked to be suppressing a smile.
"Why not just give Pierce County the information and let them follow up?"
Nolasco asked. "Because I'd already made the contact with the aunt, and I thought to blow her off would be unprofessional." Tracy shifted her gaze to Fields. "And because Pierce County had the investigation for 6 weeks and had yet to talk with the aunt."
"That was a different investigation," Fields said. "It was a missing persons case."
"Except you said you thought all along the husband killed her," Tracy said.
"There was no certainty Andrea Strickland had been murdered," Fields said, voice rising.
"Yet you immediately operated under that premise, narrowing your investigation so much that you never spoke to Strickland's best friend or her aunt, and you didn't even know about Andrea Strickland's counselor, or that her friend had also disappeared about the same time Strickland walked off Mount Rainier. Had you done your job, you would have obtained evidence that pointed your investigation in another direction, namely that Andrea Strickland had not been killed, but walked off the mountain and was still alive, possibly preventing the situation." Field slapped the table with the palm of his hand and rose out of his chair.
"Yeah, you're great with 20/20 hindsight, Crosswhite."
"Hindsight has nothing to do with it," Tracy said, rising from her chair and speaking loud enough to be heard over the others who had jumped in. "Had you done your job, the next logical step would have been to look for Lynn Hoff."
"That's your opinion,"
Field shouted back. "No, that's good detective work."
"It was no longer your call to determine how another organization conducts its investigation,"
Jessup said, also standing, his face a red beacon.
"Nor is it up to you to critique my department or to step in when you deem it appropriate. You never should have spoken to the aunt."
"Exactly how did it interfere with your investigation?" Tracy asked.
Jessup froze for an instant. Without an answer, he resorted to the schoolyard equivalent of, "It's mine."
"Because it was no longer your investigation."
Tracy looked to Martinez. "I didn't hide the fact that I spoke to anyone. In fact, I called Detective Fields on my day off and invited him to meet with me so I could immediately provide him with the information. I didn't tell him what to do with it."
Fields said,
"I had every intention of speaking to the aunt and to the friend."
"You didn't even know the friend's name. Your file made no mention of the friend or the aunt."
"Enough,"
Martinez said, quiet but deliberate.
"Everyone sit down."
After a brief pause to allow everyone to catch their breath, he said,
"Have you written up the reports of your conversations with the aunt and the counselor?"
"Yes, I was going to transmit them this morning."
"We also want the information from the skip tracer," Field said.
Martinez looked to Tracy. "I can provide the information that person uncovered," she said. "I can't provide a name."
"Can't or won't,"
Jessup said. Tracy was in a tough spot. If she said can't, it could lead them to determine that Foz had actually spoken to the Skip Tracer. The information was provided in confidence. It's irrelevant who provided it. It's the substance that matters.
We'll decide what's relevant, Jessup said.
He looked to Martinez.
We want the name.
Tracy continued her appeal to Martinez, who had a reputation for having been a good cop and protecting those that worked for him. I don't want to burn a source for an investigation that is no longer ours.
We'll talk more about it, Martinez said. Is there anything else?
No one in the room spoke. Martinez rose.
Then you'll excuse us, gentlemen.
Jessup and Fields pushed back their chairs. They shook hands across the table with Nolasco and Martinez. Tracy got glares from both men as they departed. Nolasco and Martinez retook their seats.
I want both reports on Captain Nolasco's desk by noon, Martinez said. And I want the report on the Skip Tracer to include a name. We'll decide whether to provide it or not. Take you out of it.
I'll give them everything I have. But I can't give them the name, sir.
That's not a request, Detective. That's an order. I also want you to verbally provide Captain Nolasco with a full report of your actions, including dates, times, and names, with respect to everything you did after Pierce County reasserted jurisdiction.
Do I need to get the union lawyer involved? Tracy said. Martinez shrugged.
It's up to you.
He pushed back his chair and stood.
Personally, I think you did good police work, and I never have a problem with that.
He again showed the hint of a smile before it quickly faded, and he left the room. Nolasco didn't get up.
You just can't help stepping in the shit, can you?
All due respect, Captain. Sometimes doing the right thing means stepping in the shit. Nolasco smirked.
Well, you sure have a knack for it.
He put on a pair of cheaters and lowered his gaze to a notepad on the table, pen in hand.
Who else knew about you continuing the investigation?
Tracy shook her head. No one.
No one?
He asked over the top of his cheaters. I did this all on a personal day. I don't share what I do on my personal days with people in the office. Frankly, it's no one's business what I do.
I guess OPA will decide that, Nolasco said. What about the Skip Tracer?
What about him?
That sounds like something Foz would be more inclined to know about than you.
She shrugged.
Not this time. My investigation. My call. I'm going to need his name.
I'm not going to provide it without some assurance Pierce County isn't going to broadcast it and burn a perfectly good source because of their incompetence.
That's not your call.
Nolasco set down his pen and leaned away from the table.
Can I ask you a question? Off the record.
Tracy shrugged.
Why do it?
Tracy thought of Penny Orr's statement. Because Andrea Strickland mattered. And just because the world crapped on her while she was living doesn't mean she should be crapped on in death. Someone killed her and stuffed her body in a crab pot, and the two buffoons who just walked out of here will never figure it out.
You want my opinion?
Not really, no. Nolasco smiled.
Then I'll give you my professional advice as your captain, because I'm going to put it in the report to OPA.
He paused a second.
This job is hard enough to do without making it personal. You make it personal, and it will impact not only you but those around you. Why do you think I'm divorced twice?
The better question, Tracy always wondered, was why anyone had married him.
Why do you think so many of us in this profession are divorced? You don't think I had occasion in my career when a case became personal? When I got too close and paid the price with my marriages and my relationships with my kids? You're not the only one who cares. You think you are, but you aren't. The rest of us have just found a way to shut it off. If you don't learn how to do that, eventually you'll hurt yourself and those around you.
Tracy didn't immediately respond because, for once, Nolasco made sense. For once, she couldn't dispute what he was saying. She thought of Dan and the ring on her finger. She thought of a baby in a stroller, maybe a little girl. She spoke softly. When it's my case, it is my responsibility.
But this wasn't your case, Nolasco said.
his voice also measured. Not anymore.
It was my case. It should have remained our case. The body was found in our county, in our jurisdiction. We never should have given it up.
I know you don't think I went to bat for you, and I'm not going to waste my time trying to convince you otherwise. That is not your or my decision to make. Sometimes we just have to bite our tongues and follow orders.
Why do you think Pierce County fought so hard to get this case back? She asked. Nolasco looked confused by the question.
They had it originally. They had time and manpower invested in it.
Or maybe they realize this case is going to continue to generate a lot of interest, and it could bring their entire department some much-needed positive publicity. From the blank expression on Nolasco's face, he clearly hadn't considered this and now wished he had.
But that doesn't matter anymore, she said. It's Pierce County's opportunity now.
Tracy provided Nolasco with the additional information Martinez had requested. By the time she got back to her cubicle, it was clear word had spread around the section Fishbowl that something was up. Tracy said the meeting was to ensure a smooth transition of the investigation to Pierce County. No one was buying her explanation, though most took the hint she wasn't going to say anything more. As for Kins, Foz, and Dell, she suggested they step outside. Tracy led them around the corner of the building to a patio partially shaded by an overhang. A fountain trickled water over marble levels, like a river. Tracy filled them in on the meeting in the conference room.
I don't want you taking the blame for something I did, Foz said.
Something we did, Dell said.
I asked you guys to do it.
Bullshit, Foz said. Nobody tells me to do nothing I don't want to do.
We're big boys, Dell said, and we've been at this longer than you. They can't suspend us all.
Look, I appreciate the support, but I made the decision to go and talk to the aunt, and I understood the potential consequences.
What the hell is Fields' problem? Kins asked.
I told you I didn't like that guy, Tracy said.
I'm going to call Neck and tell him the situation. He'll get the name of the skip tracer he spoke with, Foz said. You don't want to get in trouble for refusing an order from a superior officer. They'll charge you with insubordination, and they take that shit seriously. The other stuff is all bullshit. OPA will slap you on the wrist and it'll blow over, if they go to OPA at all. I doubt they will.
I appreciate that, Foz, Tracy said.
What the hell? Kin said.
He took a step closer.
Is that a ring on your finger?
He reached for her hand.
That's a diamond.
Tracy held up her hand. Dan proposed last night.
It's about freaking time, Dell said.
And you had to deal with this crap this morning? Kin said.
It is what it is, she said, feeling surprisingly calm about the situation, even about Fields. Maybe it was just the afterglow of the best night of her life, or the thought that she and Dan were getting married. Or maybe it was something said by the most unlikely person she would have ever expected to impart wisdom. Maybe Nolasco was right, for once. Maybe she needed a way to shut out the job. Maybe she was being selfish. It was no longer just about her. Her decisions could now impact Dan, and someday, possibly their children.
Tracy worked her assault and battery and other felony cases until the end of her shift, shut off her computer, and pushed back her chair.
You heading home? Kins said.
Yeah, I thought I'd make Dan dinner for a change.
I talked to Shanna, Kins said. She wants to have you and Dan over for a little celebration.
I got a better idea, Foz said, standing up from his chair and slipping on his sport coat. An evening meal hosted by yours truly and cooked by the greatest Italian chef who ever lived, my wife.
I'm in, Dell said, without hesitation. Vera's cooking? Don't get in my way, Fazio.
Sounds wonderful, Tracy said.
Maybe you should talk to her.
Are you kidding? The only thing Vera loves better than cooking is sharing the food with friends. How about tomorrow night?
I'm off tomorrow, but let me talk to Dan, Tracy said.
I can do tomorrow. Kins said. I can do any night of the week Vera's cooking, Dell said.
All right, then, let's do it tomorrow night, Foz said.
I'll check with Vera and you check with Dan.
On her drive home, Tracy took a circuitous route. She wanted to take pictures of the Alki Point Lighthouse and the restaurant, something to commemorate the evening. She'd left her phone at home last evening, when Dan had proposed, thinking they were going for a walk with the dogs. She stopped at the restaurant, taking pictures of its exterior from the sidewalk. As she turned to get back in the cab of her truck, she spotted an aluminum boat skipping across the water, and it made her think again of Kurt Schill. The young man had gotten the scare of a lifetime when he pulled up the crab pot and saw a human hand. That thought made her recall her dream. And what had been bothering her hit her like a dart between the eyes.
Chapter 24. The A-team gathered the following evening at Foz's home in Green Lake, a middle-class neighborhood north of downtown Seattle that derived its name from a centrally located natural lake. Foz had once told Tracy he and Vera borrowed $30,000 from Vera's parents in the 1970s for a down payment to buy their two-story, 2,000-square-foot craftsman home, and that the high interest rates of the 1980s had nearly bankrupted them. Now, with housing prices again soaring in Seattle, Foz was counting on the equity in the house to fund their retirement. In addition to cooking, Vera's other passion was gardening. She'd cultivated an English country garden in the front and back yards, with stone paths, rambling rose bushes, climbing plants, and dozens of perennials that would have impressed the Queen of England. Tracy had never seen it, but Foz had mentioned it, saying, "I like it, because I don't have to mow a lawn." Vera had ceded to Dell's request and cooked her famous lasagna. The seven of them, Dell was divorced, sat around a simple dining room table beneath the muted lighting of a candelabra chandelier hanging from a box beam ceiling. Tracy had worried Dan might feel out of place with a bunch of cops and their spouses, but the conversation had rarely strayed to work. Chianti and Merlot flowed liberally, and they ate in a dining room of dark wood walls and burgundy drapes that made Tracy feel as though she'd been transported to a home in a small Italian village. She had expected Vera to be exhausted waiting on them, and was surprised to find it was Foz who brought out the food and refilled their glasses, all done with a white dish towel over his right shoulder. It was clear he was proud of his wife and his home, and he considered it special to have them all together. When their plates were filled with thick wedges of lasagna, salad, and garlic bread, Foz remained standing.
"Will you sit down, Fazio? I'm like a dog with a bone that I can't eat here," Dell said.
"Hold on, hold on. Vera and I got something we'd like to do."
Foz turned to Tracy and Dan.
"When we got married, Vera's father gave us this blessing. Now we pass it on to the two of you."
Vera reached behind her and handed Tracy a basket containing a wrapped loaf of her homemade bread, a glass container of salt, and a bottle of wine.
"The bread is so that you may never know hunger," she said. "The salt is so that your marriage will always have flavor. The wine is so you will always have something to celebrate."
Foz raised his glass. His eyes watered.
"May you have many years together, and may the Lord bless you with happiness and prosperity. Salud!"
They raised their glasses and drank. Kins, too, wiped his eyes with his napkin.
"Look at all these big homicide detectives crying," Shanna said, dabbing the corners of her eyes.
Tracy pushed back her chair and stood. "At the risk of killing Dell," she said. Dell smiled.
"You go right ahead," he said.
She took a breath, fighting her emotions, which the events of the past 2 days had put to the test. "You all know that I lost my family at a very young age. I've lived alone a good portion of my life, and at times I felt like I was alone, until I made my way to the seventh floor. You people have been like family to me, treated me like family. I don't know where I'd be if I didn't have you in my life. So I just want to raise a glass to all of you and say thank you." For a moment, no one spoke. Vera raised her glass.
"Salud," she said.
"Salud," the others said. "Can we eat now?" Dell said,
drawing laughter. They ate everything Vera and Foz put on the table, and it was quite the meal. By the time they reached dessert, homemade cannoli, Tracy felt full. "I'll just have a bite of Dan's," she said when Foz handed her the plate.
"Get used to that, Dan," Foz said. "She'll tell you she's full, then she'll eat your dessert."
"When have I ever eaten your dessert?" Vera said.
"Are you kidding me? How many times have I heard, 'I'll just take a bite,' and the next thing I know my plate is clean? Last week I ordered tiramisu. I got one bite."
"Tiramisu is my favorite," Vera said, giving Dan a wink. "Who wants coffee?"
"I'll help you clear the plates," Shanna said.
"I will too," Tracy said, but Dan stood first.
"Talk with your friends. I'll clear."
Vera gave him a small hoot.
"I like him, Tracy. A man who helps in the kitchen is usually even better in the bedroom."
That comment brought more laughter. When the four of them were alone, Tracy said, "I hate to bring up work, but something has come up."
"You're not leaving, are you?" Kin said. She looked at him like he was crazy.
"No, why would you think that?"
"I don't know. I know Dan's made a good living, and you don't have to put up with the bullshit anymore."
"I'm not going anywhere," she said. "It's about Andrea Strickland."
"What about her?" Foz said.
"I don't think she's the woman in the crab pot."
Foz lowered his glass of port wine.
"What do you mean you don't think she's the woman in the pot?"
Tracy shook her head.
"I don't think that's her in the crab pot."
The three men looked dumbstruck.
"Why not?" Kins asked. "Who the hell would it be?"
"When I first got there, to the beach, the kid who pulled up the pot."
"Kurt Schill," Kins said.
"Right. He said he thought the body in the pot was a woman, though he'd only had a glimpse of her hand before towing it back to the shore. I asked him how he knew, and he said, 'Her fingernails are painted.'"
"Bright blue," Kin said.
"Right. But when I talked to Andrea Strickland's aunt, she told me Andrea compulsively bit her fingernails, so much so that they bled."
"They could be fake," Foz said. "Well, she could have stopped."
Tracy shook her head. "I asked Funk. The nails were real. And if you've ever met anyone who compulsively bites their fingernails, you know it's as difficult a habit to stop as smoking."
"Got an aunt that was a nail biter," Dell said. "After so many years, it chipped a front tooth."
They all sat back, silent, considering the information. Kin said,
"So if it's not Strickland, who do you think it is?"
"I think it could be the friend. I think it could be Devon Chambers. She disappeared the same time as Andrea, and they were about the same height and weight, similar hair coloring."
"Shit," Dell said. "This is going to complicate things."
"We don't know nothing yet," Foz said. "So then what? Andrea Strickland is dead somewhere on that mountain?"
"Don't know," Tracy said.
"You think the husband killed Chambers?" Dell asked.
"Again, too early to know. What we do know is the woman in the pot was changing her appearance, and likely using the money to do it. If Chambers knew about the money, I could see why she'd want to change her appearance."
"So what then? She and the husband were working together, and he double-crosses her and kills her?" Dell asked.
"Possibility," Tracy said. "If he used the private investigator to find her, it would explain why he gave him the name Devon Chambers and asked him to try to hunt her down, and why she was changing her appearance and clearly on the run."
"She wanted the money," Dell said.
"She didn't need to run away to get the money," Tracy said. "If she is the woman in the crab pot, she had to know about the alias, Lynn Hoff, and she had to know the bank accounts were in that name and the passwords. She had to be running for some other reason."
"She thinks the husband is going to kill her," Foz said. "Gotta be."
Tracy nodded. "Maybe. But remember, Andrea Strickland told her boss she thought her husband was having another affair. What if the person he was having the affair with was Devon Chambers?"
"I thought they were friends," Kin said.
"Exactly. What if Andrea Strickland found out her best friend is sleeping with her husband? The counselor I spoke with said Andrea could become vindictive, maybe even violent. What if the victim isn't the victim at all? What if the victim is the killer?"
Again, they all sat pondering the ramifications of what Tracy was telling them.
"We don't have the case no more," Foz finally said. "And if I go to Fields, especially without something more, he'll just run to his boss and say I stole his toys from the sandbox again," Tracy said.
"So we need to be sure," Kin said. Funk took DNA from the corpse, and Melton ran it through CODIS, Tracy said, referring to Mike Melton, head of the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab. The prior night, she'd thought through how they could be certain.
"So they have a profile in their system," Foz said.
"And Strickland has an aunt in San Bernardino," Tracy said.
"And Chambers has a sister somewhere in New Jersey," Foz said, sitting up and getting animated.
"Shit, we could do this. Would Melton run the DNA?"
"If we can get DNA from the aunt and the sister, we can send it to a private testing lab," Tracy said.
"I got an uncle served on the force back in Trenton for 45 years, Foz said. "I can ask him for a favor."
"And I have a relationship with the aunt," Tracy said.
"Yeah, but you'd still have to get Mike to release the victim's profile to the private lab," Dell said.
Tracy shook her head. "No, I just need Mike to send me the profile. I can send it to the lab."
"But what then?" Kins asked.
"Say we get the tests and they prove it's not Strickland and it is Chambers.
Then what?
Where do we go from there?"
"If we get the test and prove it isn't Strickland and it is Chambers, I go to Martinez and Olasco and tell them."
"No offense, but that didn't work too well for you last time, Professor," Foz said, using Tracy's nickname.
"If the woman in the pot turns out to not be Andrea Strickland, this case is going to generate even more media attention than it already has. It will become a national story. I don't think the brass is going to risk the publicity they could cultivate from a national story about dedicated police detectives doing their jobs to solve a horrific crime, just to make an example of us," Tracy said.
"Especially if we're right," Kin said.
"They'd have a public relations nightmare."
"Besides," Tracy said, not able to fully suppress a smile as she looked at each of them, "if the woman in the pot is not Andrea Strickland, then Pierce County no longer has jurisdiction." Kin sat back, slowly shaking his head and chuckling. Foz and Dell caught on. Soon, they were all laughing.
"You're unbelievable, you know that," Kin said.
"When did you figure that out?"
"Last night."
Foz raised his glass of port.
"Are we gonna do this?"
Dell raised his glass.
"Hell yeah, I'm in."
"Me too," Kin said, his glass joining the other two.
"If there's positive publicity to be had, yours truly can use it."
Tracy looked at them but did not raise her glass. She did not want them in trouble for something she had done.
"Foz, you're close to retirement. Dell, you have alimony. And Kins, you have 3 boys.
"You said we were family," Foz said.
"This is what family does. We do dumbass shit, but we do it together."
Chapter 25. Securing the DNA samples had not been as simple as Tracy would have otherwise predicted. When Tracy called Penny Orr the following day, Saturday, the woman had responded to Tracy's name with caution. Tracy had given considerable thought to her approach before calling. You didn't just tell a relative over the phone that the niece she thought had died not once, but twice, might still be alive. You never gave them that kind of hope until you were certain. Tracy had hoped for 20 years, against all reason and odds, that they'd find Sarah alive someday. Even after she'd become a homicide detective and knew that the chances of Sarah being alive were infinitesimally small, she clung to the thought that her sister would beat the odds, so much so that when they did find Sarah's remains, it had devastated her. She told Penny Orr they wanted to get a positive identification through a DNA confirmation and explained they could do so through Orr. To her surprise, Orr expressed reluctance.
"What would I have to do?"
"It's completely non-invasive," Tracy said, thinking perhaps Orr was under the impression she'd have to give bone marrow or blood. "I'll overnight you a DNA kit. The instructions are self-explanatory. I'll also provide you with a return shipping label so you can send it straight back to me. That label would have the personal P.O. box to which Tracy had all of her mail sent. Orr sighed, still sounding uncertain, and Tracy couldn't completely understand her reticence.
It's just that if it isn't her, then it raises doubt again about what happened to her. I'm not sure I can go through that again, Orr said.
I understand this has been difficult, Tracy said. But if it isn't Andrea, there's another family out there possibly wondering the same thing. What happened to their daughter? They deserve closure, too.
Orr seemed to give that argument some thought. After several long moments, she said,
Okay. Go ahead and send it.
Devon Chambers' sister, Allison McCabe, had also been resistant, but she too ultimately relented. Tracy suspected that whatever bad feelings had developed between the two sisters, blood remained blood. The following week, both women shipped back the tests and, with the DNA samples secured, Tracy drove to the squat concrete building on Airport Way South that housed the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab. The facility, located in an industrial area south of downtown, looked more like a food processing warehouse than home to the state's high-tech crime lab responsible for analyzing the evidence to convict murderers, rapists, and other miscreants. Mike Melton sat in his office. Today he was not strumming on his guitar or singing. When Tracy knocked, Melton was taking a bite out of a homemade sandwich that reminded Tracy of the cheese sandwiches her mother used to make her and Sarah. Two slices of white bread, mayo, and a slice of Velveeta. An apple, an uncapped bottle of water, and an open brown bag sat on Melton's desk.
"Looks like I caught you at a bad time," Tracy said from the doorway.
Melton waved her in as he chewed and swallowed, washing the sandwich down with a sip from the bottle.
"Just eating a late lunch," he said. "I was over at the courthouse working on some last-minute prep work for the Lipinski trial."
"Kin said it could go out next week," she said.
"That's what they tell us."
Melton used a napkin to wipe at the corners of his mouth visible beneath his thick, reddish-brown beard. Over the years, it had become streaked with gray. Tracy had heard the term "bear of a man" used to describe big men, but in Melton's case, the analogy fit. And not just because of his size. In addition to the beard, which seemed to get longer and fuller each time Tracy visited, Melton wore his hair combed back off his forehead, the curls touching the collar of his shirt. He also had the build of a lumberjack, with meaty forearms and hands that looked like they could tear a phone book in half, yet his fingers were nimble enough to pluck the strings of a guitar. Detectives referred to Melton as Grizzly Adams, because of the uncanny resemblance to that TV show star Dan Haggerty.
"Come in and sit."
Melton walked to Tracy's side of his desk and moved a leather satchel from one of two chairs. The other was stacked with technical books.
"A little light reading?" Tracy asked. "Just trying to stay on top of everything."
Tracy settled in. Rather than returning to behind his desk, Melton leaned against the edge.
"Heard Pierce County pulled the Crabpot case."
Melton was no dummy, nor had he just fallen off the turnip truck. As the crime lab's lead scientist, he possessed multiple degrees, none of which hung on the wall of his office. Instead of diplomas, he kept mementos from prior interesting cases: a hammer, a saw, a baseball bat. He also knew that when detectives showed up unexpectedly at his office door, they usually wanted something.
"They did," she said, "and left me with a couple loose ends I'm trying to nail down."
"Such as?" Melton said, moving back to his seat and picking up his cheese sandwich. "DNA. Given the condition of the body, it's the only means for a positive identification."
"Heard the parents were deceased and no siblings," Melton said, taking another bite.
"Found an aunt in San Bernardino. The mother's sister."
"Ah."
Melton put down the sandwich and sipped his water. Tracy had no way to soften the question. "I was hoping you'd provide me with the victim's profile so I can send it to an outside lab for comparison." Melton leaned back in his chair.
You don't like the work we do here?
It would be better at this point to let an outside lab handle it.
How are Nolasco and Martinez going to like that?
He said, the corners of his mouth inching into a slight grin. You heard about that?
I hear everything. You know that.
She smiled softly.
They'll like it probably less than they liked me going to talk to the aunt in the first place.
Melton gave her comment a moment of thought.
Well, we send out the profiles all the time when we get backed up and overwhelmed here. In fact, with the Lipinski matter taking up so much time, I was just thinking we needed to send that profile out so we could speed things up.
Tracy smiled. Thanks, Mike.
Don't thank me. Just doing my job.
Would it also be better if I didn't ask why you're using an outside lab?
Probably.
Melton nodded.
You don't think it's her, do you? You don't think it's the woman everyone said walked off Rainier?
Like I said, she has an aunt in Southern California who'd like some closure, Tracy said.
So, easy enough to find out.
Easy enough, Tracy agreed.
Melton again paused. The man was nothing if not deliberate.
Well, he said again, that is our job, isn't it? To find out with certainty so the victims' families can find closure?
I always thought so.
So my running a DNA profile would just be a means to secure certainty?
It would be, if it was still our case.
Might not still be yours, but it's still mine. I do run this division, Melton said, meaning he was the head of all the crime labs throughout the state, including the one in Tacoma that serviced Pierce County.
I got into a bit of a pissing contest with Pierce County, Tracy said.
So I hear, Melton said.
They're not going to be too happy about me doing anything to help solve their case for them.
Probably best if you stay out of the line of fire, Melton scoffed.
What are they going to do? Fire me?
The detectives knew that with his expertise, Melton could get a job in minutes at a much higher salary with one of the private laboratories. He stayed at the crime lab out of a sense of duty to find justice for victims' families.
I don't want you to have to make that choice for me, Mike.
Which lab did you choose?
ALS, she said. Melton nodded.
They're a good outfit. I know Tim Lane. He's been recruiting me for years. I'll give him a call and tell him to treat you right. Put the pedal to the metal.
Tracy pushed up out of her chair and offered her hand.
Like I said, I appreciate it, Mike.
I know you do,
he said, taking her hand.
That's why I'm willing to do it.
For the remainder of the week, each time Tracy entered the bullpen, Kins, Foz, and Dell, or some combination of the three, would give her a look like she was an obstetrician and they were expectant fathers in a hospital waiting room. Tracy would shake her head to let them know the lab had not called. That Friday, as she worked a homeless man's stabbing case, her cell phone rang. The screen indicated no caller ID, but the prefix was for a Seattle number.
"Detective Crosswhite?"
the caller asked, causing a flicker of anticipation in her stomach.
Speaking.
Mike Melton says I'm supposed to treat you right. And given the size of him, I don't want him angry at me.
ALS had an office in Burien, not far from the Seattle Police Academy, about a half-hour drive from police headquarters. Tim Lane said he could email Tracy the results so she could avoid the drive, but Tracy didn't want to leave a paper trail on her computer. She told him she needed to talk to a witness down his way and would pick up the results. Strange as it seemed, she also didn't want to hear the news over the phone, and Lane didn't question her further. He might have already sensed something was up when he realized he wasn't calling police headquarters, but a private cell phone. Tracy and Kins took his BMW rather than a car out of the pool. They did have a witness they needed to speak with in Des Moines, which was just next door to Burien, just in case anyone accused them of using taxpayer time to run down evidence in a case that was no longer theirs. ALS was located in a business park that included a brewery, a fitness gym, and, apparently,
a basketball club. The number of private laboratory services had exploded with the recent advancements in DNA analysis, and the concomitant desire of private citizens to find out their ancestry, genetic makeup, and proclivity to get future life-threatening illnesses.
"You done it yet?" Kins asked Tracy as he pulled into a parking space labeled in white block lettering as reserved for ALS visitors.
"What? Get my DNA profile?"
"No."
"You?"
"Nah. What do I want to know that for?"
Kins pushed out of the car, and Tracy exited the passenger side.
"My dad's father had Alzheimer's. I worry enough about that stuff without someone telling me I should be worrying. When they tell me they know how to cure it, that's when I'll want to know."
She met him at the hood, and they walked toward the entrance.
"What about your ancestry, your heritage? Aren't you curious?"
"All my life I've grown up thinking I'm English, and believed I had to tolerate tea, bland food, and cold and foggy weather. What am I going to do if I find out I'm Italian and could have been eating like Fazio all these years? Besides, you keep going back far enough and we all came from the same place anyway. Had to start with just two, right?"
"God, that means we're related to Nolasco?" Tracy said, pulling open the glass door.
"I'm pretty sure Nolasco's a reptile."
Tracy told the receptionist they had an appointment to see Tim Lane, and they stepped toward chairs in a waiting room with low ceiling tiles, fluorescent lights, and rich blue walls lined with posters spelling out the lab's various available services.
"This place looks like the preschool we used to take the boys to," Kins said.
Two couples sat waiting. Tracy had also read that parents were getting their genetic makeup analyzed before having children, to determine if their offspring were at risk for genetic disorders, such as sickle cell anemia and Down syndrome. At 43, Tracy's odds were greater than younger mothers of passing something on to her child. A door in the corner of the room pulled open, and a blonde-haired man, partially bulging, stepped out wearing a white lab coat over a pink dress shirt and red tie.
"Detectives," he said, giving them a 100-watt smile.
"I'm Tim Lane."
They shook hands.
"Come on back."
Tracy and Kins followed Lane down a carpeted hallway. He led them into a nondescript conference room with a window that looked out over a small area of once green lawn, showing patches of brown. Lane stepped to the far side of the table, on which he'd set two manila folders.
"Mike says you're to get the VIP treatment," Lane said,
his voice deep and rich.
"Heard you've been trying to recruit him."
"The detectives would revolt," Tracy said.
"We worked at the crime lab together many, many years ago," Lane said. "I only lasted 5 years."
"How'd you get into the private sector?" Tracy asked.
"I majored in chemistry and went back for my MBA. I've always been entrepreneurial and wanted to run my own business. With the advances in DNA and the backlog of cases at most major metropolitan crime labs, I saw an opportunity I thought I could fill. We were one of the first private labs. Now you Google private DNA testing, and you get a couple hundred thousand hits."
"How much of your work is for the general public?" Kins asked.
"It's about 60% now. When we first opened, we were basically an annex for the crime labs. We did a lot of paternity testing. Over the years, with advances in DNA testing and technology to perform that analysis, the crime labs can get through their cases a lot faster than they could when I was there, and don't have as much of a need for outside labs. Eventually, you won't need us at all. You'll get the bad guy's DNA profile, put it up on a cloud, and it will run through all the major databases and spit out results in minutes."
Lane sat. Tracy and Kins took two chairs across the table from him.
"Mike also said you guys don't need any hand-holding. So I'm going to get right to it, if that's okay?"
"That's fine," Tracy said. Lane opened the first folder. "We use the profile Mike sent us as our baseline for comparison with the two DNA profiles you provided. The first profile, we were asked to determine if the person could be the victim's aunt."
"Correct," Tracy said.
"We can determine with a much higher degree of certainty whether two people are related," Lane said,
slipping into his comfort zone.
Tracy and Kins had both received educations about DNA testing and analysis through their work on several trials, but Tracy let Lane continue. Her father had once taken her to buy her first six-shooter, and although he had been shooting six-shooters since he could walk, he had patiently listened as the seller went through every aspect of the gun, then thanked him for his thoroughness. When they left the store, Tracy asked her father why he had endured the lecture.
"Interrupting a man when he's discussing his profession is like telling him what he has to say isn't important. Besides, you never learn anything when you're talking."
Lane continued. "But without the DNA from at least one parent, we can't be certain."
"The parents are deceased," Tracy said.
Kin said,
"So what did you find in this instance?"
"In this instance, we performed a statistical analysis based on the match type typically expected for a known aunt-niece relationship.
This provides us with what's called a kinship index. A biologically related aunt and niece typically have a kinship index value greater than 1.0. Conversely, if they are not biologically related, the kinship index value is less than 1.0. The closer to or more distant the kinship index value is to 1.0, the more or less likely the two individuals are related."
"And in this case?" Tracy said.
"In this case, the kinship index value was significantly less than one." Her adrenaline spiked, but Tracy did her best to temper her reaction.
"So they're not related?"
Lane shook his head. "The statistical probability is they are not."
"You said statistical probability," Kin said. "What are we talking about here? What are the percentages?"
"Negligible. If you want percentages, I'd say it's 99.95% they are not related."
Kins glanced at Tracy, but also didn't say anything. She knew him well enough to know the wheels were spinning in his head, too.
"And the test to determine siblings?" Tracy asked.
Lane closed the one manila file, slid it across the table to Tracy, and opened the second file.
"Again, the recommended method to determine whether individuals are true biological siblings is to test their parents. DNA paternity and maternity testing will always provide conclusive results. That not being an option here, we are again left with probabilities. In this case, based on the type of genetic material inherited by each sibling, we determine what's called a sibship index."
"What did you find?" Tracy asked.
"The sibship index was well over one. The statistical probability is that the two women in the genetic profiles you provided are full siblings." Tracy and Kin stepped outside the lab, with Tracy holding the results of the two tests. Kin slid on sunglasses against the bright glare.
"I'm not going to lie. A part of me was hoping we'd get the opposite result."
"It would have made things a lot easier," Tracy agreed.
"But not nearly as much fun," Kin said. "And easier is never a word I've associated with you."
Tracy stopped at the car passenger door, raising a hand to deflect the sun's glare.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Kins used the remote, and the doors unlocked with a chirp.
"Don't get defensive. I'm just saying it seems like lately if something can go wrong in one of our cases, it usually does. It would be nice to get a grounder every once in a while."
They pulled open the car doors and slid inside the BMW. Kin started the engine to get the air conditioning going, but didn't look to be in a hurry to get moving.
"What do you think happened?"
"I think we'll make a mistake if we speculate. I think the question at this point is, what does the evidence tell us?"
"At this point, I'd settle for just about anything that made sense," Kin said.
"Well, we know now for certain that Andrea Strickland is not the woman in the crab pot," she said. "It's Devin Chambers."
"No doubt about that," Kin said.
"We know Andrea and Graham Strickland were having marital problems and financial problems. The business was a massive failure, and the bank, the landlord, and other creditors were banging on their door with personal guarantees that Strickland couldn't begin to pay off. We also know Andrea was sitting on a pile of money she wouldn't let him touch, and that she was afraid he'd somehow put at risk with the creditors."
"All true," Kin said.
We also know he cheated on her, and, if you believe what Andrea told her boss, that he was continuing to cheat on her. Maybe with her best friend.
Was he? Or did she just want people to believe he was